Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy today is John Cass, johncassnews.com. John.
Hey, Dan. Good morning, everyone. Great to be here.
Good morning. Great to have you. So it's a Charlottesville Redux after this weekend's Trump rally in Dayton, Ohio, where Trump talked about a bloodbath. And this was taken by the left to be yet another in an endless series of incitements to violence by the former president. Here's what he actually said in the context of it, which is kind of important.
Let me tell you something to China. If you're listening, President Xi, and you and I are friends, but he understands the way I deal, those big monster car manufacturing plants that you're building in Mexico, we're going to put a 100% tariff on every single car that comes across the line, and you're not going to be able to sell those cars. If I get elected, now, if I don't get elected, it's going to be a bloodbath for the whole, that's going to be the least of it. It's going to be a bloodbath.
Yeah, so clearly talking about it with respect to the automotive industry, but and talking about it economically, generally speaking.
Wait a minute, not the way CNN tells it. For God's sake, you turn on CNN, you think the President Trump is calling for the slaughter of anyone who doesn't vote for him.
Right. Well, this was what they immediately seized upon and were all over the usual places saying the usual things. Here's Biden comms director Michael Tyler.
What I heard was a continuation of the same rhetoric, the same endorsement of political violence that we've seen from Donald Trump for years, as you pointed out. It goes even farther back, right? This is the same guy who, after Nazis marched on Charlottesville and killed a woman, said there were very fine people on both sides.
So there it is, Charlottesville Redux. It's more Trump and his white nationalist cadre of extremists that are seeking to end our democracy, make him president for life, install martial law, round up non-heteronormative people of color, and the American experiment as we know it. But I mean that. Yeah, and sure, of course, that logically follows from the bloodbath comment.
That is pathetic, but that's what they do. That's how they roll.
This is, again, you have to vilify your opponent. I mean, certainly that's what they believe. They have two chances here. One is a criminal conviction, so they can run $500 million of you can put a convicted felon in the Oval Office. We just can't have that in America. And the second chance is to scare enough people about end times to not look at their checking account, to not take a look at what's happening in their schools, to not offer any review and assessment of what's happened to all the institutions they used to trust.
But how do organisms respond to constant stimuli, negative stimuli? Like if you're in a cage and they're jabbing at you with a sharp stick over and over and over, day after day after day, do you still respond to it? Because that's what the media is doing to the middle class of America. They're jabbing us with a stick. Do we respond? I mean, when are we supposed to join them? Or when the door finally opens, are we supposed to grab them and go for their throats, which I'd like to do? I mean, well, what do we do?
I mean, again, I'm responding to being jabbed with a stick. I mean, you know, we're sentient beings, but we're also sapient beings. So you're supposed to employ that mass between your ears and process this thing a little bit, right?
Okay, so process for me.
So, look, I think if we've talked about before, and actually Lance Morrow has a good piece about it in the Journal over the weekend, that this is, you know, has the feel of the Weimar Republic or at least 1968 Chicago. And that's what I think is going to happen if Trump wins. So, you know, this is just the left doing what the left does, which is projecting onto their opponents who they actually are and what they actually condone. I mean, is the summer of 2020 that long ago? Is, frankly, the comments from the Pelosi's and the No Justice, No Peace, Maxine Waters, and so many others in the Trump era, I mean, are those all forgotten?
I just don't even know why there aren't uprisings all over the country, and maybe there will be.
People need to start taking to the streets. This is a dictator.
You know, there needs to be unrest in the streets for as long as there is unrest in our lives.
Enemies of the state.
Show me where it says that protests are supposed to be polite and Fredo. Peaceful.
Do something about your dad's immigration practices, you feckless.
When they go low, we kick.
How do you resist the temptation to run up and wring her neck?
The biggest terror threat in this country is white men, most of them radicalized right up to the right.
I thought he should have punched him in the face. So even if you lost, he insulted your wife.
Yes.
He came down the escalator and called Mexicans rapists and murderers. He said, well, what do you think I should have done? I said, I think you should have punched him in the face and then gotten out of the race. You would have been a hero.
I'd like to punch him in the face. I said, if we were in high school, I'd take you behind the gym and beat the hell out of him.
Okay. Punch some people in the face.
When was the last time an actor assassinated a president?
They're still going to have to go out and put a bullet in Donald Trump, and that's a fact.
Look as his character is stabbed to death.
Where is John Wilkes Booth when you need him?
Who said that?
Just a little old lady, Kathy Griffin holding up Trump's severed head. You know, you've been around for all of these. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. You've been around for all of this, and I would take Trump's posture and make it your own. What did he say? My vengeance is going to be success.
Right.
My vengeance is going to be the country's success, and by extension, you know, you, the American people, your success. And that's the posture I would take. So how do you respond to what they have said and done and continue to say and do? You remove them from power, and you focus on your own success and America's by extension. How's that?
But in the meantime, as we're moving towards that, can we have a few well-placed kicks to the special purpose to drive those special purposes up and out through their mouths? Because when I hear Van Jones talk and incite violence while the network that he's working for is screaming about inciting violence on the Republican side, I want a guy who's going to kick them right in the special purpose.
Well, I mean, metaphorically, I mean, yeah, with respect to media organizations, I don't know. I mean, it might be a nice start if Republicans could defund NPR. Why do we have state-funded media that propagates the left's position?
The NPR Times, too?
Yeah, the NPR Times, too. Yeah. The other thing, though, too, is just, again, to do your best to explain to people what they're doing. I mean, Nancy Pelosi, what you saw over the weekend with this bloodbath comment, which is, you know, a complete tempest in a teapot. But what you saw is the old wrap-up smear. Nancy Pelosi told you, you know, 7 years ago how it works. And there's been countless examples of them employing it. So, you know, just tell your less informed friends, listen to, especially on the left, listen to Nancy Pelosi, and then see if what you're watching them do, for example, this weekend over the bloodbath comment, doesn't fit this description.
We call it the wrap-up smear. If you want to talk politics, we call it the wrap-up smear. You smear somebody with falsehoods and all the rest, and then you merchandise it. And then you write it, unless they see it's reported in the press that this, 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 and this, so they have that validation that the press reported the smear, and then it's called the wrap-up smear. Now I'm going to merchandise the press's report on the smear that we made. And it's a tactic. And it's...
Yeah, it's a tactic.
Well,
and it's one that Nancy Pelosi used this weekend. Once it had been merchandised and reported, then Nancy Pelosi went on CNN with Dana Bash to do her part in completing the wrap-up smear.
He's even predicting a bloodbath. What does that mean? He's going to exact a bloodbath? There's something wrong here. How respectful I am of the American people and their goodness. But how much more do they have to see from him to understand that this isn't what our country is about? Praising Hitler, praising the Russians, honestly, I mean, condemning our soldiers for losing or dying in war or being captured in war. He said, what's wrong with Russia? They defeated Hitler. What about the millions of Americans who risked or gave their lives? What about him saying that soldiers buried in Europe, he didn't want to visit them because they were losers?
Mm-hmm. That was the occasion.
Did he say that?
No. He didn't say a lot of the things that she said. But this is the occasion to not only do the wrap-up smear on bloodbath, but to bring out the garbage bag and dump everything on the floor. And that's what she did. I mean, she says this is a tactic we use. Then she uses it. I mean, do you want to take judicial notice of that? It's pretty straightforward. Kevin, Austin, Texas. You're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Don.
Hey.
You're absolutely right. The best success is to live well, or the best revenge is to live well. And also, there's Johnny should be familiar with revenge is a dish best served cold.
Especially from Green Acres, Indiana, now that I serve it constantly to my Jacobin colleagues, former Jacobin colleagues of the leftist paper that I used to work for. Yeah.
Right. And the best way to do that is to win elections come November. Now, you got to go to war with the army that you have, and there are going to be opportunities in DuPage County to get House members to help whoever the Republican is going to be. And it's not just about Trump. It's about getting rebuilding a Republican Party in Illinois from the combine that you guys talk about.
Thanks for the call, Kevin.
This is the Morning Show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So, I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630. And learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and John Cass in for Amy this morning. JohnCassNews.com. And John, before we get to the Cook County State's Attorney's race and the primary election tomorrow, just one little point of institutional memory here, since we were talking about the bloodbath comment that was surrounded by hysterics, performative hysterics from the D.C. press corps after Trump used that in the context of talking about the auto industry. I mean, not to mention, even if you use it in terms of like talking about the election, other than an explicit advocacy for violence, I mean, it's hardly a novel term to use in so many different contexts. But of course, you know, the press seizes opportunities where it can, and in service of its Democrat socialist comrades. So just to set the record straight, provide the context on the bloodbath comment so you hear what he actually said. And then also, since it's being, of course, compared to Charlottesville, the lie that they've told about Charlottesville for the better part of 7 years, even though, again, I stipulate that it would be much more helpful for Trump if he was more precise in his language. But that's sort of by the boards. You understand what you're going to get with Trump. And so you have to into account what you know he is attempting to try to say, rather than in the light ridiculously least favorable to him. So anyway, what Trump actually said about Charlottesville and the neo-Nazis that were present in 2017.
People that were very fine people on both sides. You had people in that group, excuse me, I saw the same pictures as you did. You had people in that group that were there to protest the taking down of, to them, a very, very important statue and the renaming of a park from Robert E. Lee to another name. George Washington was a slave owner. Was George Washington a slave owner? So will George Washington now lose his status? Are we going to take down statues to George Washington? How about Thomas Jefferson? What do you think of Thomas Jefferson? You like him? Okay, good. Are we going to take down the statue? Because he was a major slave owner. Now, we're going to take down his statue. So you know what? It's fine. You're changing history. You're changing culture. And you had people, and I'm not talking about the neo-Nazis and the white nationalists, because they should be condemned totally. But you had many people in that group other than neo-Nazis and white nationalists, okay? And the press has treated them absolutely unfairly. Now, in the other group also, you had some fine people, but you also had troublemakers, and you see them come with the black outfits and with the helmets and with the baseball bats. You had a lot of bad people in the other group too.
It's just amazing because the way that it's referenced, as it was by Michael Tyler, Biden's campaign comms guy. Oh, Trump said of the neo-Nazis, there were some fine people in that group.
Yeah.
That's 180 degrees from what he said.
Sounds like, describing that sounds like Rex Hupke, my former colleague at the Tribune. But they'll just twist whatever they can get and tear it apart, no matter what he does, to paint him and all those who would vote for him as beyond the pale, outside the norm. So kick to the margins of society. And what do they do when they finally get back in? Are they going to be nice, or are they going to grab for the tomahawk too? That's the point.
Well, I also too, just like, come on. Listen to what he actually said and then tell me that you can go along. That is not open to interpretation. Listen to what he actually said, and then you can sit there and nod your head and say, oh, yeah, Trump was flacking for neo-Nazis in Charlottesville.
Nonsense.
In fact, what he was talking about, there were some fine people in the group of leftist protesters, and then there are other, like Antifa types, that are goons. I mean, it's just so dishonest, and it can't be called out enough as far as I'm concerned, particularly because you know that they are just in the business of repeating something for long enough and amplifying it.
Well, what's the
significantly enough that it becomes the truth to a wide swath of the population, and they don't have to answer for it because they never have to respond to a conservative media, for example.
For those of us who are in the media consumer group, how are we best to respond to this type of thing? Constantly, because they're just beginning to ramp up.
Well, I mean, I think you respond like I just said. I mean, first of all, you have to share the truth. You have to like grab that Charlottesville clip from what Trump actually said in 2017 and present it. You have to take the full minute riff he did at Dayton, Ohio, talking about a bloodbath, and it was about tariffs on Chinese made cars and facilities they're building in Mexico. And if he doesn't win, it's going to be a bloodbath basically for the auto industry. That's what he was talking about.
Right.
But that's a separate, like, whether that's an, whether that's sensible public policy is sort of a separate issue, but that's what he was actually saying. And so, I mean, you have to present what is actually being offered. And hopefully you would think that most fair-minded people will say, yeah, okay. Okay. And that undermines the credibility of people who don't deserve to enjoy any credibility, like all of those news readers on all of those usual suspect cable TV stations. I don't know what else you do. I mean, well, you tell me.
Well, I don't want to attack them physically, and I guess laughing at them hysterically, like, is something for the Twitterverse, but not for real life. But I think that would be a good response, what you're talking about.
Phil in Merrillville, Indiana.
Hey, guys, morning.
Hey.
I think if Trump gets in, he should start a Department of Factual Information, and I'm not talking like the Democrats where they want to, you know, censor people. And anytime the fake news posts something like this, they could basically post it on their website and play the actual full clip of Trump or one of his cabinet members or whatever it may be, and they could get the true information. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for the call. That's not the business of the federal government or any government. That's the business of the of a private citizen.
Well, I'm a private citizen, so every time a talk show host on another fake conservative news station demands for the execution of a member of Congress to just drag them out into the fields and shoot them, can I make light of that and mention it?
Well, of course, but I'm just saying, like the last thing we need is another government agency.
Yeah,
I'm from the government and I'm here to help. Right, those are the nine scariest words in the English language. I don't care who the president is. I don't want more government agencies in the business of telling me what the truth is.
Right,
right? This is something that, again, you have to pay attention. You have to identify trusted sources. You have to do your own sort of engagement with reality, and you flesh it out amongst yourselves. Nobody is the oracle of truth on this planet, that's for sure. All right, I want to get to the Cook County State Attorney's race, because I don't know that I've heard you weigh in on this. Yes, well, now you are. No, you're going to. We're going to compel you to. So, Clayton Harris, who is the Preckwinkle selection, the Kim Fox protege, who would give Kim Fox an A if you were grading her. Her
nothing
performance
has to
is
be
A.
changed about her, right?
Okay, right, steady as she goes. and then there's this retired judge, Eileen Burke, who is, playing the Vallis game, basically, as I would describe it.
Kim Fox light, yeah. But still enough Kim Fox to kill you if you adopt it. So I wouldn't take that either. I don't think either one. I mean, look, if I'm going to handicap, I'd see a low turnout election in Cook County. Most of us who would vote against Clayton Harris have left. We've already left. We're just waiting for the others to turn off the lights. So I think that Clayton Harris will win this election. But here we come to the next election.
Does it matter, Harris or Burke?
Next election, there's not really too much difference between them. And the next election is with, you've had him on the show, he's a nice fellow, Bobby Fioretti, but come on. I mean, just hearing his voice on your air tells me how low the Republican Party in Illinois has fallen. I'm sorry. I listen to you every morning and love the show, but Bob Fioretti is not the answer to what people want, and neither is Mr. Harris, of course, absolutely not, or Burke, who is Tony Preckwinkle light. So, I don't know, where are you supposed to go? The lesser of two weevils? Come on.
Yeah, right. It's not dissimilar from the election they had in Russia over the weekend. So it's interesting, though, to look at this. You know, Kim Fox, when she burst onto the scene, she was she had the Democrats, particularly the wealthy honky Democrats in the suburbs, all excited. You know, Kim Fox in 2016.
And the newsrooms.
Of course.
God, they loved her.
Rich, you know, honkies in the newsroom, yeah. Sure. Fox, she got 45% of the vote in Cook County suburbs in 2016. That dropped to 29% in 2020. But in 2016, she won most of the North Shore.
Perfect.
Yeah.
She should be their state's attorney in perpetuity after that.
55% of the Democrat socialist honkies in Winnetka, 57% in Glencoe, 54% in Wilmette, 54% in Kenilworth. I mean, these are, John, those are the most educated, successful people the world has ever seen.
Is that just the awful vote, or is it the entire Democratic?
That is the percentage that she got in those communities in 2016. Now that dropped, and they're like, well, okay, after
the riots.
Well, after an embarrassing 4 years, now I guess it's okay if we don't go with a magical black woman.
And now we just get a magical black man?
Just because she's a black woman, right.
Yeah.
So they went with the, you know, the honky scion of a billionaire because they're used to that. That's what you do. Like Jelly Belly Pritzker, who they enjoy as well. I just love zeroing in on the North Shore just to remind people how astoundingly ignorant that people who make more money than most of us are.
And people think that they're wiser because they make more money, but they're really not. Yeah. Well, the people should know is that for us, like those of us who are not part of that ruling North Shore clique, they hold us in contempt, thorough contempt, sort of like the way CNN anchors and executives hold and ABC executives like and people like George Stephanopoulos hold us in contempt.
Yeah, yeah.
They just despise us.
Yeah, well, the problem is that the feeling is not mutual among enough of us.
Because
the feeling is mutual with me. You cannot have more contempt for a person than I have for these North Shore champagne socialist dilettantes. You cannot have more contempt for a person. These are the worst human beings in the world.
Yes,
there is no sort of just punishment that I would not cheer. Everything that they support should be visited in their backyard, and in some cases, I mean that literally.
Which is why
everything they support. And so here's the New York Nutrier Democrats banner. This is the berry they can't carry around in you know May Day parades and whatnot. Here's the Nutrier Democrats agenda: end gun violence,
right.
Tackle our climate crisis, defeat hate, stand up for our public schools, build a vibrant, sustainable, and inclusive community.
Does that hate mean like the hate that they have for Dan Proft and John Cass? Is that
yeah.
Hate?
The problem is you don't have enough people that are willing to communicate to these sorts of individuals exactly who they are and what we think of you.
There's only the two of us. There's me, you, Sean Thompson. That's it.
You don't need a radio show or a column to communicate to people in your neighborhood exactly what you think. You don't need any sort of media profile to take it to people who are basically enemies inside the perimeter of your community and this country. I mean, the awfuls, the school board meetings, you see it because you see like Nutrier Neighbors and some of the members of that organization.
They're
they'll go to school board meetings and they'll put the fight in. But I mean, there's just not the same willingness to shame. What did David Mamet say? What the left really fears is exclusion. What the left really fears is exclusion, which is why they preemptively exclude. They preemptively marginalize. So they're always the in crowd. And sensible center-right people, conservatives. I'm talking about in these communities, too, because these things are community-specific. Let's think about this at the granular level.
Right.
There's just not the willingness to go to that place and publicly ridicule these people and shame them the way they deserve to be shamed for what they participated in. Remind everybody that the geniuses in these wealthy enclaves, wealthy honky enclaves on the North Shore, were all big Kim Fox fans out of the gate in 2016. Dan and John Cass in for Amy J, Chicago's Morning Answer.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one, Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today, 773-467-5630. 773-467-5630, or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and John Cass in for Amy J this morning, johncassnews.com.
Hey, Dan. Good morning, everyone.
John, the evictions have started at the migrant shelters in Chicago.
Wait a second. I thought he wasn't going to do that. Then he was going to do it? What happened?
Well, what happened is they identified 36 migrants to be evicted from shelters on Sunday, which, again, just means that they can go to the landing zone and reapply for a bed there. So there's this landing zone at 800 South Des Plaines where they can go apply for a bed.
Right.
But of the 35 individuals that were supposed to exit three of the city's 23 shelters, only three did, it goes the reporting.
Three out of what?
Three out of 6,000?
You know, I stopped worrying about Brandon Johnson's inability to manage anything. All I see is the Edvard Munch painting, the scream, every time he opens his mouth, because I imagine what's going on inside of him. He has absolutely no idea what's happening. And it shows.
Well, they got three, so three down and 6,000. So I mean, they're not going anywhere anyway. The people with families with kids in CPS, they don't have to go anywhere because, of course, CPS. This is the whole point. This is why they're never going to go anywhere.
Right.
CPS needs those kids in the school for their average daily attendance numbers, which drives the state funding they get.
With or without measles, right, Dan?
That's right, and. Only adults without children under the age of 18 would be eligible for eviction. And then even that small cohort, then you've got the the possibility of reapplying for a bed in the landing zone. And God knows whatever other country programs and arrangements are being made. You know, this is, of course, against the backdrop of BLM Brandon wanting to borrow $1.2 billion to build affordable housing over the next 5 years.
Well, I think you should. Uh-huh. Why stop it? Why not 10? 10 billion. Borrow $10 billion. It's just money. They just print it and get Democrat votes as a result of it. They just buy votes. It doesn't matter. Inflation doesn't matter. Your consumer price index doesn't matter. They don't care about that. They want the votes. They want the leverage with the money.
Well, there may be an opportunity in the suburbs, thanks to the possibility that, speaking of state money, $3 billion in bonds the state may sell to give the White Sox a new stadium, the Bears a new stadium down on the lakefront, if they can get by Friends of the Park. So that Arlington Heights property the Bears have. State Representative Mark Walker, he's a Democrat socialist from Arlington Heights. Of course he is. Democrat socialist representing the Northwest burbs, like the Northern burbs, like the Western burbs, like the Southwestern burbs. Yeah. All the burbs. Mark Walker said, if they go forward with their lakefront plan, talking about the Bears,
yeah,
it's our responsibility to make the decision for the best decision for Arlington Heights, Rolling Meadows, and our neighboring communities. I look forward to many interesting proposals to come on the future of Arlington Park, like new business development, more affordable housing, or welcome centers for our new arrivals.
I would much rather them build thousands of tiny houses and have like a village for, you know, migrants, for illegal immigrants. They could live there,
make it a planned community for migrants.
Yeah, and they could
build them their own, build them homes.
But they
homes.
Could have like little fires going outside, to like tripods with pots to make stew and so forth. Yeah, it would be good.
So there you go. It's a possible suburban solution. That's a great plot of land there. I'd love to see some Section 8 housing and planned community for people in this country illegally, wouldn't you? And Arlington Heights, those of you who elected Mark Walker, 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line.
I'd put it there. I would also, I don't know, I think we have to designate a series of neighborhoods throughout the North Shore for little tiny houses and squalor and children running around barefoot among the cinders and playing with fire. Yeah, it would be perfect.
You've got Bill Malusian reporting from the border. I mean, it's just this just continues unabated, all the blather and all the talk, and all you see is people walking right through holes in the border fencing and into this country. A breach around Lukeville, Arizona, Tucson, Arizona sector continues to see the most activity. And you see hundreds and hundreds of people just coming in and then taking selfies to memorialize their entrance into the United States.
I think they should go to where the Democrats have the most power and reach, and that is in Illinois. That's on the North Shore, clearly. That should be. They should be sent there.
I totally agree. I don't know why there is not a move to take over the parks. And if you had an organized Republican Party, I'd be paying for the busing to bring them up into Wilmette and Winnetka and Kenilworth and Glencoe and Highland Park and Glenview and Northbrook, and take over your public parks, take over your downtown.
You forgot Western Springs.
Your community houses. Well, that's not the North Shore, but yeah, for Western Springs, Hinsdale,
yeah,
Naperville, Downers Grove, all of it, Glen Ellen. That's
maybe
exactly
get
what
some
should
good
be happening.
Soccer going on.
You want to be downtown on Elston, or do you want to be in leafy Glen Ellen next to Glen Oak or something?
Right.
That's exactly what should be done. This is what I'm talking about. We don't have we here in Illinois, because obviously Greg Abbott has the gumption and Ron DeSantis has the gumption. But we don't have a Republican Party here. We don't have any leadership here. We don't have anybody that would say, yeah, that's exactly what we're going to do. We're going to visit it upon these communities so that you can live your values. Just as Josh McBroom suggested a sign-up list in Naperville for all the people who wanted to bring those newcomers into their homes. And that created a bit of a firestorm because God forbid you ever call people out on their bull jive. That's the one thing we won't
do. There's one thing wrong with
that. That's the one thing we won't do in this state, and that's why there is no opposition party and there's no real interest. There's just a concession to how things are and sort of like, you know, hoping against hope that somehow somebody from a distant planet is going to save us.
Was it, I don't know, is it the result of years of the dailies where people had it beaten into them to go along? Or is it, when I see Pritzker now, they're going along with Pritzker. He's destroying the scholarship program. They destroyed the scholarship program to benefit the teachers. And people go along with the looting of their own neighborhoods, basically. That's what they're doing. They're looting their own neighborhoods. And they're just nodding their head, going along, voting Democrat, voting Pritzker, hoping Pritzker will save them.
Trump took up Pritzker at his rally in Dayton, Ohio over the weekend.
He's done such a bad job. But you look at what Democrats have done. Look at Illinois. I don't know how it continues. You have this guy Pritzker. I don't know. He's too busy eating. He wants to eat all the time. Would you like a hamburger? How many do you want? Five? I'll have five burgers, please. You go to his office. Would you like a hamburger? Yeah. Okay, I'll have five burgers, please. Who the hell orders five burgers? But look.
That's our Governor Wimpy. Corey and Woodlawn, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
And you made me laugh before I got to say my statement. But here's what I do want to say. I mean, I don't say this with a grin on my face. We don't read. We haven't read The Road to Serfdom. We haven't read Free to Choose. But we do have evidence of how this ends. We had Cabrini Green. We had Rockwell Garden. We had Ida B. Wells. We know how this housing ended. The government is the worst landlord. He is the worst provider. Those buildings stunk. They were death traps, gangs ran them. They were the open drug markets. We know how this ends. The citizens need to have the gumption to get these guys out of their pocket. And Cass is right. They're going to steal the wealth in our housing. No one's going to want to buy your house and a giant housing project behind it. This is ludicrous.
But why do they keep voting for Democrat? Great call. But why do people keep voting Democrat? Particularly, why do black people keep voting Democrat? Why do black women keep voting Democrat when Kim Fox and Tony Preckwinkle and Judge Evans and that crowd keep releasing thugs from the jail that attack black women? Why do they go along with it?
Well, it's a unique case here in Illinois.
Really?
As compared to the rest of the nation. I mean, there's some overlap, but there's something unique about Illinois, and that is there is no Republican Party. There are no Republican candidates. Like right. I said the other week, at least like California Democrats are at least sort of making an attempt with Steve Garvey. At least in New York, you win some congressional seats on Long Island. You have a Lee Zeldin that runs a close gubernatorial race against Kathy Hochul. Yeah. When you want to talk about like the most non-existent Republican Party on the mainland, you know, outside of Hawaii, maybe.
Right.
You're talking about Illinois. So why don't they vote? Why do they say, like, what are you talking about? What's the Republican Party? That's like that they don't even have enough self-respect to present themselves as an option. So why would anybody pay attention to them? They didn't pay attention to themselves.
And that's why everyone moved to Naples, Florida, right? Where we're going to be, you and I, next week.
We are going to be there Thursday evening at Royal Point Siena. It should be a fun evening. Some updating, too. I know, per Joy Reid, that migrant crime is negligible.
Right,
but
white crime is terrible.
Just more stories, and these stories will get amplified in the coming months, I can guarantee you. Guatemalan migrant accused of police officer's death, released after case dismissed. This was a teen migrant from Guatemala arrested following the death of a police officer. He was approached by this police sergeant in St. Johns County in Florida, and he resisted. A struggle ensued, and the officer had a heart attack and died. He's in this country illegally. He resisted arrest.
It's called homicide.
An officer died. Prosecutors dropped charges against this guy.
Wow.
Agents in Uvalde, Texas, arrested an illegal migrant from Ecuador. He is a child predator with a 2014 conviction for sexual assault of a victim under 13, serving 6 years in prison. So there you go. Just another one.
I remember.
Wait, I'm not done. Yeah. A twice deported illegal working as a teacher in Maryland. He was arrested, charged with sexually abusing multiple minors. One of the victims was 6 years old. He is now in custody again. Illegal alien from Haiti has been charged with raping a disabled girl. I think we brought that to you last week, but we'll bring it to you again. This is in Boston. Mm-hmm. And then just on the again, all we can do is tell stories, anecdotes, and people can use that to inform their understanding of what's happening or not as they see fit. Illegal migrant from Lebanon caught at border admitting he's Hezbollah terrorist and he was hoping to make a bomb and head to New York.
Because that's where you want to go with bombs, New York. Yeah.
Well, here again, I mean, this is the point that was made by even the FBI director, even people that were otherwise not particularly sympathetic to or particularly impressed with. But everybody sees what is obvious if you're looking.
So who's going to wear the jacket when the terrorist happens?
When the terrorist attack happens?
Yeah. Have they so thoroughly polluted news media that it'll be like a both sides thing? Like the Republicans failed to push, immigration reform through Congress, and so therefore they're all at fault.
I don't think so, because the two parties are saying two very different things about the border. And not to mention, for President of the United States to say, essentially, I can illegally forgive student loans, but I can't legally secure the border, you know, the power that I do have. I just don't think people are going to buy that. When they see these videos, like I was talking about with Malusion and all these people coming through the fence in Lukeville, Arizona, and then Biden said, well, you know, I'd love to do something, but Congress won't let me. He looks impotent. He looks pathetic. He's not credible. And I don't think they buy it. And as I said, they're saying two very different things on the trail. Here was Trump over the weekend.
It's a bad. These are animals, okay? And we have to stop it. We can't have another Lakin. We have so many people. We have so many people being hurt so badly and being killed. They're sending their prisoners to see us. They're sending and they're bringing them right to the border and they're dropping them off and we're allowing them to come in. And these are tougher than anybody we've got in the country. These are hardened criminals. And we've got hundreds of thousands of them. And we're not going to take it. We're just not going to take it. We're destroying. They are destroying our country. I'm telling you. He's the worst president we've ever had and the most incompetent president we've ever had. And he's also the most crooked president we have ever had.
And to Trump's point, a Venezuelan Supreme Court judge warning that violent convicts released from Venezuela are increasingly part of the migrant stream pouring into the United States. Oh, yeah. You don't say.
This is the Mariel boat lift times 100.
Yeah, it is. Exactly. And we're going to have more Lake and Rileys until you get either a new president or a new policy or ideally both. Dan and John Cass in for Amy J. Chicago's Morning Answer.
This is the morning show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. Only the biggest stories. Only the biggest guests. And only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and John Cass. JohnCassNews.com. In for Amy J. this morning. And, John, as we were discussing a bit earlier, a little bit of a firestorm manufactured by the D.C. Press Corps on behalf of their clients, the Democrat Socialist Party, after Trump made this comment at a rally in Dayton, Ohio over the weekend.
Let me tell you something to China. If you're listening, President Xi, and you and I are friends, but he understands the way I deal, those big monster car manufacturing plants that you're building in Mexico, we're going to put a 100% tariff on every single car that comes across the line, and you're not going to be able to sell those cars. If I get elected, now, if I don't get elected, it's going to be a bloodbath for the whole, that's going to be the least of it. It's going to be a bloodbath.
And then the customary hue and cry followed with charges that Trump was once again advocating political violence and our democracy is at stake, and he and his band of goons are a threat to the American public, and so on and so forth. You're familiar with the concept.
As we speak, I'm watching it right now on CNN, the pouty-faced CNN anchor Kate Boldan exhorting people right. to hate on Trump.
Disturbing news out of Dayton, Ohio this weekend as the president calls for a bloodbath. Right. Yeah, no, we get it. We get it. And so does John Solomon. Actually, John Solomon has a good piece. Legacy of Deception. Democrat-led, taxpayer-funded machine exposed anew for misleading Americans. What do we do about it other than explain the ruses that are afoot? It seems to me that maybe we're taking the bait and focusing on worrying about what CNN or MSNBC are platforming for their 15 viewers when we should be worried about what the new Marxists are doing with respect to the new arrivals as it pertains to elections. And there should be more talk about the mechanics of elections, particularly in states that don't have a particularly good track record of late, like Maricopa County, Arizona, in administering elections. And you've got same-day voter registration, and you have no ID requirements.
The Attorney General of the United States has ruled that if you want voter ID, you're racist, basically, right?
Yeah, but so here's the thing. The bloodbath silliness over the weekend, that demands a response.
Yeah.
So that people get the full context, and then they invoke Charlottesville, and you have to go back and bring in Charlottesville and what the president actually said to expose the mendacity of the left. But I mean, the propaganda machine, you can't do anything about other than what I just described. The administration of elections, that is what this is all leading to, you can do something about. And I wonder if enough is being done about that. For more on this, John Solomon, award-winning investigative journalist, founder of Just the News, justthenews.com. John, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, great to be with you guys.
So the bloodbath moment over the weekend, a good example of the sorts of things you're writing about in your piece.
Yeah, listen, it's obvious what the context was, that if he wasn't elected, if these policies weren't put in place, that the country would continue down the decline that it's been in the last 4 years. But the media can't report it honestly. They have to look for every gotcha moment and try to contrive gotcha moments. They've been contriving things, really, since 2015, 2016 with Russia collusion, something that I played a big role unraveling. And then over the last 6 to 8 years, they have repeatedly misled the American public. And if you're listening to CNN today, or if you're watching it, or you're reading the New York Times, you're willfully choosing to be misled, because those publications have misled this country over and over and over again. The record of inaccuracy and dishonesty in the last 8 years in those publications is enormous. And so if you're watching them, you're making that choice. You want your bias confirmation to be confirmed. But most people are now being much more choosy in the news. They're reading lots of more sites, to make sure that they get a more complete 360-degree look at it. And one of the greatest examples of it is you look at the polling. 2-3 years ago, less than 20% of Americans thought Joe Biden had done something wrong in Hunter Biden's dealings. Today, 65 or 67%, I think it was, in the AP NORC poll found that Joe Biden either did something illegal or unethical with his son. How did that happen? It didn't happen because they read the New York Times or the CNN. It happened because they listened to your show. They read my site. They're getting news from other places, and they're realizing, hey, we've been misled by the establishment press. And I think that that is the answer to this. Every time there's a false misuse of a quote in a Trump speech or an effort to censor something that was actually accurate, we just have to speak up. We have to write and get around the blockade. And the truth of the matter is the mainstream media has made themselves significantly less relevant the last 8 years by constantly being wrong.
In your piece, Legacy of Deception, Democrat-led taxpayer-funded machine exposed anew for misleading Americans. And I recommend it highly to everyone that I'm talking to today and everyone that reads John Cass News and so forth, because I just think it's very important to call out in specific, like, for example, you call out in specific Adam Schiff in this piece, who promoted a lie to the American people that Trump was an agent. I know it's hard, difficult to even discuss it without laughing.
It's crazy. But
an agent of the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
Trump is a Russian stooge, to quote some of the media with that. And you call it out. But is that what we're supposed to do? Call it every time they do something like that? Call it out?
Absolutely. Listen, that's the gift that our founding fathers gave us, the gift of free speech. And thus far, though that left has tried to take it from us with the censorship regime, it has prevailed. And I think the more it prevails, the more we use it to our advantage. 4 years ago, Rumble was not really a large platform. Today, it's a very large platform. There are alternate news, social media sites taking root every day, giving us alternatives around it. There are new news sites like mine and all the great radio shows that are out there today. There is a way to just keep using it. Now, listen, there ought to be other penalties. We ought to sue when we're wrongly defamed. We ought to sue when we're blocked from speaking. You have to use the courts. The courts have been a tremendous ally of the original rights that our fathers gave us, even when Congress and the White House haven't always been. But the biggest alliance has been watching Democrats in Congress work with their allies in the media and their friends in the social media world to try to impose narratives that were laughable. And, you know, just one example, I use it in the story, but when you think about it, the common person in America goes, of course that's silly. The January 6th committee chose to credit the third-hand hearsay account of Cassidy Hutchinson that President Trump, on his way back from the Capitol, or on the way back from the Ellipse, tried to hijack his own presidential limo. He allegedly assaulted Secret Service agents and grabbed the steering wheel of the presidential limo, the Beast, and take it to the Capitol. That was a third-hand account when the committee had a first-hand account from the driver, which it did tell the American public about for 3 years, that it never happened. All the agents in that car said that never happened. By the way, it's not physically possible. The limo had infrastructure between the president and the driver. He couldn't get in there. But they were able to carry that out and have the media covered and CNN run it live on television because of this alliance. And we just have to break the alliance up by continuing to tell the truth around them.
So one of the ways to do that, as you said, is to tell the truth around them. But how many articles were written by the New York Times, by the Washington Post, using that line, that lie, as fact? In their narrative, not even as an opinion, as narrative fact. How many times? And are we supposed to constantly point out every time? Is that what we have to do every time?
In the current world we're in, I think we have to keep doing it for a while. And I think over time, the boy that cries wolf phenomenon sets in, and you start to see a lot of sites. Listen, BuzzFeed, which gave us the original Russia collusion story, Christopher Steele,
right. It
doesn't exist anymore as a news site. Over time, the American public are so wise, they will choose and abandon sites that that mislead them and gravitate towards sites where they can get the truth. A lot of the major news sites, Vice, which leaned to the left and obviously had an agenda, they're in significant trouble closing up in many ways. the American people vote with their wallet, they vote with their eyeballs, they vote with their feet. Right now you see people leaving blue states. You see them leaving liberal news sites, and you see them leaving liberal policies that have left our country aflame. I think the more we tell the truth over the next couple of years, the more the country will self-correct itself. The greatest mistake that the New York Times and the CNNs and the Democratic parties and the Adam Schiffs make, they believe the American people are stupid. They think they can keep bamboozling them. That is the single greatest liability to their future that they have. They misunderstand the American people. We're busy. We're trying to make ends meet in this economy, but we're pretty smart, and the Democrats don't realize that they keep trying to fool people, and it's going to come at their own detriment.
Yeah, and I think a lot of more and more so, and BuzzFeed is a good example, is they're talking to each other, and they don't have a monetizable audience, which should tell you something about the kind of influence they wield. It's not nothing, but it's diminished. Go back to the other thing I mentioned, though, too. I agree with the need to respond here and set the record straight on these matters. But what about these other things that I don't think it has penetrated? I think there's a general concern and uneasiness about the administration of elections, but it's a little bit more sterile. It's a little bit more complicated. Things like same day voter registration in Maricopa County, where you've got the Tucson sector is the most active sector when it comes to illegals crossing into this country, and where the Republican Party is at in terms of ballot integrity and vote by mail programs. Seems to me like we need to do more discussion and reporting in this area, if for nothing else than to prompt attention and conversation and maybe prod the Republican Party to do more than it's doing.
Yeah, listen, I think the last 3 weeks have shown a significant transformation of the Republican Party on this issue. And I have a full-time election integrity reporter. There's not many people in the country that have a news site that has a full-time reporter. We think it's that important. That said, dead people, I'm sure, have been voting in Chicago for a long time. And there has always been.
That's the Chicago way, buddy.
Yeah. It is. Yes. And in Detroit and Philadelphia, there's always been efforts to run up the score. And yet, for a long time, Republicans have won races in those states. I think the single biggest learning from 2020, and it took the Republicans 4 years to learn it, not two, but four, is that we live in an era where people are either too busy or too lazy to vote on election day. And on the left, it tends to be couch potatoes. On the right, it's people working two and three jobs. But if you make it easier for them to vote by working with them on getting them registered, getting them to vote early, because maybe they can't get on election day, they got the kids at home school or two jobs to try to make ends meet, you can even the score with what the Democrats have done. The Democrats have built the largest early get out the vote operation in American history. If Republicans do half as much as the Democrats do, they start election day much closer, and of course the election day vote tends to go much more in favor of Republicans. That's the that's what you hear Laura Trump talking about now. That's what Michael Whatley did in North Carolina as the Republican Party chair in that state. That's what Ron DeSantis won when the poll showed him winning by 10%. He won by 20 in 2022. Early voting, once the Republicans master that, this scale will be leveled again.
Is there time enough though between now and this election to do that?
There is. There's three things going on. There's a lot of lawsuits being filed every day. So the RNC, the new RNC, filed a lawsuit last week. That was big. But there have been nonprofit groups or 501c4s that have been working on this for 2 years. They weren't going to trust that the RNC could come around in time to do it. So they went out and they raised a lot of money, and they built an army in the field, an infrastructure in the field that can rival what the Democrats have. It's been going on for 2 years very quietly. It hasn't been chronicled. But it's going on out there, and I think it's that nonprofit system or that 501c4 system combined with the RNC that will help the Republicans have a much more even playing field on early voting. And if that happens, I don't think we'll be talking about theft of election in the 2024 November timeframe. I think we'll have a different outcome. I think that's the place that Republicans just lag behind, and they unilaterally disarmed for three elections, 2018, 2020, 2022. Now they're in the game, and I think that's going to make it a much different looking election come November.
John Solomon, award-winning investigative journalist and founder of Just the News. Do check out his most recent column, Legacy of Deception. John, thank you as always. Appreciate it.
Real good
Great
stuff.
Great to be with you guys.
Really good stuff.
Thank you.
And he joined us on the turnkey.pro answer line.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and John Cass in for Amy J. JohnCassNews.com. It's where you find his writings and the writings of his contributors and his Chicago Way podcast and all that good stuff.
Yeah. Like a cup of good common sense, Midwestern style. Yeah.
There you go. Bibi, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, he took to Fox and Friends over the weekend to respond to the comments made by Pagliacci Schumer on the Senate floor last week that we discussed. Schumer, the upshot is calling for new elections in Israel because Bibi needs to go because I guess the claim is that he and other unnamed parties within his administration are bigots. And, you know, they haven't done a good enough job at trying to limit civilian casualties as they prosecute the war against Hamas.
They're bigots because they're trying to... Bibi is what? He's Jewish and he's trying to protect his state from attack? Yeah.
Yeah, well, as we know, I mean, this is just Schumer playing domestic politics and pandering to, I don't know, say a constituency in Dearborn, Michigan that could be problem, you know, that could cost Biden Michigan if they're not careful. I think that's what the calculus is. It has nothing to do with Israel's interests, peace in the Middle East, eradicating terrorism. It has everything to do with domestic politics. And Bibi sort of saw through that, responding thusly.
Joe Biden says he liked the speech and also said your policies are hurting Israel more than helping Israel. Your response to Chuck Schumer and the president?
I think Schumer's statements are wholly inappropriate. I think we're not a banana republic. The people of Israel will choose when they'll have elections, who they'll elect, and it's not something that will be foisted upon us. That, you know, it's wrong to try to replace the elected leaders of a sister democracy and a staunch American ally at any time, but especially during the time of war. Just imagine that after 9/11, and when you're in the midst of fighting al-Qaeda and winning, people will say, oh, well, the right thing, people, some Israelis would say, oh, the right thing to do is not to have new elections in America or have President Bush resign. It's inappropriate. Shouldn't have been said. It's wrong. As far as my considerations, they're not for my personal survival. They are for the survival of the Jewish state. And that requires pursuing the war. It's something that support that my government enjoys the support of the overwhelming majority of Israelis. And let me tell you something, not only the majority of Israelis, but the majority of the American people.
For more on this, please be joined by Stephen Bucci, who served America for 3 decades as an Army Special Forces officer and top Pentagon official. He is a visiting fellow at the Heritage Foundation's Allison Center for Foreign Policy Studies. Stephen, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
It is always my pleasure to be on the show.
So was Bibi's response on Mark?
Well, I thought it was a little tepid, frankly.
Right.
If I had been in his place, I don't think I would have maintained quite that level of professionalism that he did. I would have told Chuck Schumer where to stuff it. That last time I checked, he wasn't a voter in the nation of Israel. So his opinion about who governs in Israel is worth a cup of warm spit. So, no, Chuck, we don't really care about your opinion. I'm not even sure Chuck's still a Jew at this point, you know, as he talks that way, it's absurd. It's. I mean, if you're worried about election interference in America, then where do you get off trying to dictate to another democracy how they should decide their policy or who should be the leader? Last time I checked, America didn't get to dictate to the rest of the world the who sits in the head seat of a government.
How difficult does it make the job of a warfighter to have domestic politics and hand-wringing like Schumer? Dan believes Schumer, and I agree with him, is undercutting Israel to appease Michigan votes. how difficult is it for the warfighter in the position of risking their lives to be out there and having to deal with this stuff?
Oh, it complicates it incredibly. It just complicates. There is a slice of Israeli politics who don't agree with what the government is doing. And they're a democracy. They do have differing opinions across the political spectrum. So for somebody like Schumer to pander to that small slice of the Israeli electorate, when you're right, it's exactly based on pandering to a critical slice, according to their evaluation there in the American Democratic Party, to pander to that small slice of radical left people, predominantly. It's not just in the Dearborn community in Michigan. There's pockets of it in other places as well. Some of them not Muslim or Arab. They're just radical left Americans who just really hate Israel. But it is a tiny minority compared to most of the American electorate. So to pander that way and undercut an ally when they're fighting a war to
survive,
try and eke out a little bit more domestic voting is wrong.
So where does the campaign against Hamas stand? You know, there's been this back and forth with Bibi sort of thumbing his nose at the Americans and others who've called for him not to invade Rafah, and him basically saying, look, we have to go into Rafah if we're going to come close to eradicating Hamas. And so that could be the last piece of it even. So where does that all stand?
Well, I think we're right on the edge. Israel is very close to, I don't know if we can really say eradicating Hamas, but making Hamas so weak that they're a non-player, which is what we all hope will happen. But to suddenly pull the rug out from under them and say, oh, we're going to condition our support or we're going to change our position if you don't suddenly back off at this last minute. Look, this is an administration that it just came out this weekend was having secret meetings with Iran to put more pressure on Israel to cut off this attack. At the same time, they're releasing to Iran another $10 billion in aid. Their priorities are screwed up. The American administration's priorities are screwed up, and it's going to hurt Israel in their effort to make their own people safe. I don't think that will dissuade Bibi from doing what he needs to do, but it's sure going to make it harder for him. And this is not what an ally does. An ally stands with the people that are on their side that have stood with us unconditionally, and now suddenly we're playing politics with them. It is really a low blow, in my opinion.
There's been a change in the mission statement of the United States Army. The old mission statement read, to build, educate, train, and inspire the Corps of Cadets to be commissioned leaders of character, committed to duty, honor, country, and ready for a lifetime of service to the Army and nation. The new mission statement removes the MacArthur troika there of duty, honor, and country. Duty, honor, country replaced with Army values. Duty, honor, country is sort of a seminal speech in the history of the country and certainly the armed forces, certainly the United States Army. And it seems to be like the three sort of characteristics, values that you would think of when you think of our armed services. But there's a desire to make those more generic, just put them all under the heading of Army values, whatever Army values are. Let's not be explicit about it. How do you react to that?
Well, first of all, I mean, General MacArthur's speech did not develop those three. Those three were the motto of the military academy when General MacArthur was a cadet. So it was a long time ago.
Yeah.
And he was exemplifying it at the end of his career. He was still holding that as the highest depiction of the values that we are supposed to live by, the creed that a graduate of the military academy is supposed to live by. to suddenly put them in. Look, the Army values are fine, but there's something that is the calling of everybody that joins the United States Army, everybody that enlists, from the youngest private to the most senior officer. But to remove the duty, honor, country from the mission statement of the academy, I'm sorry, the academy is a little different. It's not the entire Army doesn't go to the United States Military Academy. Selected people. It's a small slice of our officer corps. So should there be a higher, a little more intellectual depiction of the things that motivate and give direction to those officers? Should it be a little different than the values of the whole Army? Yeah, it should. It should be higher. And we all thought duty, honor, country was the epitome of that. The present leadership of the Army is being driven by, the woke nonsense that's causing them to have a enlistment crisis. They can't get people to join because good American mothers and fathers don't want to send their sons and daughters to an organization that is confused about what you call people and that spends as much time given classes on, debunked critical race theory as it does training them how to fight.
Well, that's the thing. It's not about Army values. It's about the removal of, from the West Point credo. It's about the removal of duty, honor, country, and what we're supposed to understand about what West Point is with that decision. What does that tell us about what has become of that institution?
What it tells you is that the leadership has been either pushed into or even worse, believes themselves that we don't have to have anything special for the military academy. We just need to use what we use for everybody else. Back to the common denominator. It's not a bad denominator, but it is the lowest common denominator of values for everyone who joins the Army. And the creed of the military academy should be something higher. Duty, honor, country exemplified that. And the leadership saying, oh, no, it's nothing different. It's really the same thing. No, I'm sorry. It's not, General. You're wrong, Secretary of the Army. Get a life and look at the people you're leading. Perhaps ask them before you make the change.
They're asking these young men to risk their lives. So if you're risking your lives for what? To make fries at McDonald's? Is that what it is? Like nothing more than that? No.
Yeah, and no, you're absolutely right. It's not just that. It's not the lowest common denominator. The men and women who graduate from the military academy have accepted a higher calling than the citizens in general, certainly, but from the average soldier as well.
Yes.
Doesn't mean they're better. But they have chosen a different and, I believe, a higher path. And taking this creed away from them, it's a crappy leadership, frankly.
Weaklings.
Stephen Bucci served America for 3 decades as an Army Special Forces officer and top Pentagon official, a visiting fellow at the Heritage Foundation's Allison Center for Foreign Policy Studies. Stephen Bucci, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. I'll talk to you next week.
Thanks,
very
Colonel.
Good. And Steve Bucci, join us on the Turnkey.pro answer line.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and John Cass, news.com, in for Amy this morning. And John,
yep.
You're still a member of PETA, right?
I love PETA because I love animals with lemon, garlic, and mostly lemon.
Oh boy, I'm not going to tell them you said that. They have a new campaign, the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, these raving lunatics. And it has to do with when you take a picture.
Pardon me?
It has to do with when you take a picture of somebody and you say what? Say cheese.
They don't like the forcible extraction of milk from the goats and ewes?
Let me tell you something. Cheese is nothing to smile about.
And one, two, three. Say baby slaughtered for veal.
Baby slaughtered for veal.
Say calf-cow separation.
Calf-cow separation.
Repeated and forced impregnation.
Dehorning and tail docking.
What does tail docking have to do with
it? No.
At the end, it's just, it's so touching. The say cheese, and this little girl says no, because cheese is nothing to smile about. By the way, I do like, I will start doing that. What was it? What was the veal one again?
And one, two, three. Say baby slaughtered for veal.
Yeah.
Baby slaughtered for
veal. I'd say baby slaughtered for veal are delicious.
Especially when you massage them and rub them to make them as tender as possible when they're babies. And then devour them. Saute. Don't overcook. I'm telling you this.
Yeah. All right. Well, I thought you'd enjoy that.
Like the Gina Giorgetti way, you know, like the Erie Cafe. How you doing way. Yeah, like that.
I thought you'd, being the gourmand that you are, I thought you'd appreciate that.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy J. This morning, Tom, John Cass, that is, johncassnews.com. And, John, so we've got this recruitment problem in Chicago Police Department and a lot of other major metropolitan police departments are having the same problem. And at the same time, you've got the politics in major metropolitan areas, which is, of course, all left, hard left, identitarian left.
Do not prosecute, do not chase, do not arrest. Yeah.
Well, that's part of it. And then then just the internal composition and culture in the police departments themselves. So what's happening there and how will that impact crime fighting ability, public safety provision, even if you did have proper leadership at the chief, local prosecutor, local chief judge levels? Nashville may be a case study. Nashville wants more women on its police force by any means necessary.
It's a male-dominated profession, so women are scared to take that step, maybe thinking that they're not able to do it, but you can do it if you have that right mindset.
It's a mindset the Metro Police Department hopes more women will have. Their goal? A 30% female police force. Last year, it was 11%. This year, it's 13%.
And is it even attainable?
I think we're definitely growing, so if we can just keep that momentum going, I believe that it is definitely attainable.
Commander Tiffany Gibson is Metro's first female director of training. She says among the biggest changes they've made to help attract recruits, especially women, no more physical ability tests. Oh. Now trainees must pass a physical agility test designed to mirror tasks in the field. They've also added lactation rooms for nursing moms to all 8 precincts, more flexible schedules. That's in addition to their already paid maternity leave and sick time.
What's something the Metro Police Department does not currently offer to female recruits that you think could really be a game changer?
We were trying to get going, possibly help sponsor our own childcare facility, and I think that would be really helpful for females.
And updated travel times, possibly traveling.
New officers like Emma Long hope it all leads to more women joining her on patrols and beyond.
More qualified and strong women to be in this police department and be leaders in this police department. I mean, I think it would be a great thing to see.
Oh, God. Oh, God. Lactation rooms? Yeah. Wow.
That was the NBC affiliate in Nashville reporting uncritically on the topic. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line.
Can women be good cops? Yes. Can they be good cops in an environment that seeks to, I guess, undercut law enforcement? No.
Well, I take it a step back. I mean, the physical ability test for a physical agility test. Why?
Because
the 30%, we have to get to 30% of women on the police force. Why? How is that going to enhance public safety? I mean, maybe there's an answer. I don't know. But it seems to me that's the question. Everything that we're in the business of providing public safety. So anything that we do, whether it's testing requirements or arbitrary quotas, there should be a basis to say we're doing this because it's going to improve public safety, right? Isn't that the premise of the organization, of a police department? So if you can't give me an answer as to how changing a test or establishing a arbitrary quota improves public safety, then why are you doing it?
Because mayors want to get elected and they want to reach out to women, and women voters apparently are so enamored of having other women not protect them that they're I don't know.
Well, I mean, my point is this. My point is, like, nobody ever asks just the predicate question. I'm not into, like, the 30% and you want more women on the workforce and lactation. By the way, there is such a thing as chest feeding now. Men can chest feed.
Yeah, so. I can have children. I can have my sons.
You can have a butt baby and you can chest feed it. That's possible. But seriously, like,
Lent is beginning for me, so I don't want to get myself screwed up there. I want to purify my soul as best I can.
Well, again, my point is just, like, if you can't answer the question that relates to the purpose of the organization,
right,
to justify a policy change you're making, then what are we talking about?
You're talking about more guys getting shot or more women being female police officers being beaten half to death, like that poor woman on the west side, the sergeant. She had some meth head she was trying to deal with, and she was afraid that she didn't want to lose her job by putting her hands on him. And he ended up getting on top of her and beating her half.
You don't want a physical ability test, and then you see a video like we saw a couple months ago of, I think it was 5 female cops trying to detain 1 male suspect, and they couldn't do it.
What happened?
Well, he just fled after he, you know, pushed them around and away from him. But that's not the point. The point is did that physical ability test have something to do with the job? And if it did, then why?
Yeah,
are you changing
it's called
it?
Putting your hands on people.
Yeah,
but they don't do that anymore. The cops. When I was a kid, cops were hired to put their hands on people. You had rough people out there, and you needed rough people to corral them.
Yeah, well, that's still the case. I mean, you saw it on the streets of Chicago this weekend. If you saw some of the videos that were circulating on social media, one it looked like it was somewhere near the lakefront. But I mean, you know,
teen gatherings,
yes, kids being silly, right? Yeah. The usual things, and you know, and this guy is a big dude, and a cop is, I think he was going for a gun, and a cop is, you know, trying to corral him, and then another cop comes and they get him down and corral him. But I mean, so I'm not saying that women can't be cops either, that women don't serve heroically, Ella French.
Of course.
But I'm saying what does changing requirements and establishing quotas explain to me how that improves the Nashville Police Department? From a public safety perspective, not from an identitarian political perspective. And if you can't answer, and first of all, the point is you should press people to ask, to answer that question.
100%.
And if you don't have a good answer for it, then the policy doesn't make sense.
All the policy does is it promotes insecurity of the purpose of the job. And that's when you get people hurt, when they don't know what they're doing or how to do it. and they have bad training. And we see that all the time. All the time.
Joe in Naperville.
Yeah, two quick things. Shame on that reporter for not pressing on how that's going to make the country safer. And number right. two, why don't all the dudes just say, identify as women and fill those roles, and they could sit back in the lactation room and play cards?
Yeah, actually, call well, because, I mean, I know that's tongue-in-cheek, but...
Is it?
Well, I mean, obviously, there are people that go into law enforcement because they want to, you know, enforce the law. They want to be out there doing
They're
something.
Shepherd dogs.
Yeah.
They want to protect people. Yeah.
Doing something that, you know, gives them, like, worth and value to what they do 8 hours a day. Greg in LaGrange, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi, good morning, guys. The thing I guess I would press, too, is what Dan said. If you want to reach a quota, and you want to pare back the physical test for women, how have you explain the police departments need to explain how they reimagine the police department's roles? And to John's point, if you're no longer allowed to handle a criminal physically like men used to be able to do, then what's the difference between having a man and a woman there, other than to meet a quota? Anyway you look at it, they're in a trick bag. They can't answer that question. Then again, they'll never be asked that question. That's where we're at. But that's what I'd like to see answered.
They pull their service weapon, Greg. And they shoot somebody. And then a mother's crying and Father Flager's out there screaming for their head. That's well, what happens. So you can't put your hands on people. You end up and you're trying to direct them or force them to do something they don't want to do, like the meth head is twitching, so he doesn't want to get, you know, on the ground and so that you could put the cuffs on him. Then you're forced to shoot him or tase him. And I've seen what happens when coppers who are otherwise well-trained, like see an old man, 98 years old, with a urinary tract infection, and they're told by their commanding officer to attack. And that means an old man gets shot in the guts with a shotgun round.
Well, what does that have to what does that have to do with quotas and relaxing physical standards?
Well, what I just said, because when you're not able to control somebody, you'll end up, and you're trying to do your job, you'll end up going to higher force. I don't know what the technical words are, but you're going to go, instead of, you can't do your job, so you can't impose your will on somebody, and you have to impose your will. That's part of the job. So then you'll just get a taser or a gun. Isn't that what happens when you have weak people that are doing the job?
Carl in Northlake.
Good morning. You know, this is liberal idiocracy 101. It's all about intention. Be damned about the outcome. And the outcome will not be good, as John just stated. They will have to go to higher force.
Thanks for the call, Carl. I mean, well, yes and no. I mean, I guess it's like a reasonable person standard when it comes to the escalation of force, but obviously the unit is less capable. That's the problem. If you're having to relax standards to include people based on their identity, then you're making the unit weaker. I mean, we saw this with Ranger School in the Army. The same thing was going on, and it's absurd. I mean, that's not even a close call. And by the way, people, I'm sure, say, oh, well, you know, you see a lot of cops out there. They don't look like they could pass male cops. They don't look like that. They could pass a physical ability test either. Well, they, at least in Nashville, they had to get on the force. And maybe that's a conversation then, is that if you're especially if you're a street cop, that you need to maintain a certain health standard to pass a certain fitness test.
Yes.
To stay on the street. That's the point. The point is it should be about public safety, not identity. I don't want to get into identity. I want a public safety organization to be focused on public safety. That's the point.
Point well taken.
Kurt, Northwest Side.
Yeah, hi. This is, I was a Chicago police officer a little over 27 years. So was my wife. Back in the day, women that got on, they got on for the right reasons. They wanted to be part of this institution and actually go out there and do police work.
Mm-hmm.
You've got good police officers that are women and bad police officers that are women. Same thing with men. You have good and bad. The whole issue is exactly what you said. This is all about identity. And you're going to get the wrong group of people thinking the wrong thing, and that's going to inevitably get people killed.
Thanks for the call, Kurt. Brenna in Plainfield.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
29-year retired state trooper. I was one of the pioneers of women on the state police. The only thing I can say about Nashville's attempt at recruitment is going to undermine why women police can do the job. You're going to have resentment from the men for the accommodation, plus passing or bypassing the standard of the physical agility is foolish, both for the women and the men on the department, for their own safety.
Yeah, okay. Thanks, Brenna. Brenna probably gave me a ticket during her time as state trooper. I'm sure. I think I've gotten a ticket from most of the state troopers over my time in Illinois. But what Brenna said, that makes perfect sense. It's sensible. Like, I don't know. All this stuff seems to me like so straightforward, and I think for commonsensical people, it's so straightforward. But when identitarian politics imposes itself, then all logic is out the window.
You want straightforward and calm demeanor, but on the street, that goes out the window when you have adrenaline pumping and people screaming, and you're fighting for survival, and there's no calm demeanor then. There's no rational approach then.
Candace, Mount Pleasant, Wisconsin.
Good morning. I have a theory, and then I'm going to give you my example. In the movie 1984, remember the scene where the state is talking and the women are just crazy, and the narrative said, the women bought the narrative more than anybody else. Well, I think the left loves women in these positions because they eat it up and they love the power and they'll do anything the state says. And my example of that are teachers, the teachers union. Look what they've done to the kids. They deserve that. And they will do anything the state says for a paycheck.
Thanks for the call, Candace. I mean, it's a overgeneralization, but. Lee and Hammond.
Hey, guys. You know, in the spirit of equity, where does it say that you have to have anything like licensing certification? Why is it that you can't be an airline pilot if you're blind? Why is it you can't be a surgeon if you haven't got use of your hands? I mean, it's all discriminatory. You know, if we're going to be reducing it to the lowest common denominator, I mean, how about, if you really want somebody on the police force that has expertise in crime, why are we discriminating against gangbangers and people with felonies? Why don't we just include them?
Right. Who knows more about crime than criminals? Exactly.
Exactly.
We could have a Pac-Man 2 revolt. Yeah. Sure.
Well, I mean, again, our very own senior senator, Saka Durbin, has proposed, along with our very own junior senator, Tammy Duckworth, has proposed that people who enter this country illegally could serve in our military and have a pathway to citizenship. So we are right now culturally in the direction of rewarding lawbreakers at the expense of law abiders. So, yeah, that would be in keeping. I think Lee may be onto something. Dan and John, Cass in for Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560 The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and in for Amy J. Today is John Cass, johncassnews.com.
Hello, Dan. Good morning, everyone.
And so the outgoing message for our former climate czar, John Kerry. Outgoing message. We're on the cusp of an exciting time in human history. We're about to undergo a green transformation that will dwarf the Industrial Revolution, says John Kerry, man of science and data.
This will be expensive to make the transition through investment. No country in the world has enough money to do this by itself. But if we mobilize the private sector into infrastructure, new grids, water treatment facilities, transportation, laying down the power lines and so forth, those are jobs. Those are jobs for electricians and heavy equipment operators and plumbers and steel workers and so forth. And so this is a moment of looking at the greatest economic transition that is potential there if we seize the baton and we go do it. And it is larger even than the Industrial Revolution transformation that took place in the 1800s and early 1900s. That's our possibility. And there's no question in my mind that if we do what we know how to do and what we promised to do, we will actually make the world, let me stop myself and just put one thing in front of you. Currently, 7 million people are dying around the world every year because of pollution, because of the bad air quality. That's greenhouse gas pollution, folks. We know what we have to do. It's the burning of fossil fuel and not capturing it, the emissions, that is the problem. So we don't need a new algorithm defined. We don't need a rocket scientist to define what's the problem. We know what the problem is. It's simple. It's us. The choices we make about how we light our homes, our factories, power our vehicles, and so forth.
We know what the problem is. We're the problem.
Get rid of people. Life without people. I love it. It's the environmentalist dream.
Save the planet for who? Right. To that end, the EU, of course, is fully bought into this degrowth strategy. The farm-to-fork strategy, this is what is in part driving all the protests you've seen from European farmers. The
French dairy farmers outside the gates of Paris, yes.
The strategic goals for the EU: reduce farmland by 10%, fertilizer by 20%, and pesticides and antimicrobials by 50%, which would reduce total EU ag production by at least 12%, and then obviously force importation may also have an impact on the global food supply that would be negative. But
I can't get decent brie now. In American
yeah.
brie.
Well, there are going to have to be some sacrifices if we're going to get to net zero by 2050. That's what I always say. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Bjorn Lundberg, president of the Copenhagen Consensus Think Tank, author of Best Things First. Bjorn, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Dan, it's great to be back.
John Kerry is a noted man of science and data. I know that because he says so. What do you think of that dissertation?
Well, look, there is a problem with global warming, but it should worry you when he's basically selling it as, yes, this is going to be fantastically costly. It's going to be bigger than the Industrial Revolution. And if we succeed, we will have exactly what we have today. We will have plentiful energy that's cheap and available, but only if we've spent a fortune. That's a really, really hard sell because we already have that today. Now, we do need to fix eventually the climate problem, but you're not going to fix it by throwing trillions. And we are literally talking about many, many trillions of dollars each and every year. On average, over the 21st century, it's estimated we'll have to spend about $27 trillion a year. Just for reference, the current global GDP is about $100 trillion. So we're talking about spending an infathomable amount of money on getting this transformation. That's just not going to happen. It's not going to happen in rich countries like the US and the EU because we can't afford it. But of course, it's not going to happen at all in China, India, and Africa, which are the places where most of the emissions are going to come from the 21st century. So we really need to find a smarter and better way than this, just let's spend all the money we have and a lot of the money we don't have.
And while they're figuring that out, the EU is seems intent on dealing a pretty sizable body blow to its agribusiness sector. I've seen data that suggests that if the EU had zero emissions, it would make a 0.13 degree Celsius difference in global climate by 2100. So, I mean, it's just like the expenditures and the sacrifices and the transformations. And what's the payoff again?
It's fairly small. You need to get a realization. This is not about what rich countries do by themselves. I mean, we can make ourselves as poor as we want to. It's not going to fix climate change unless we get China, India, and Africa on board. And they, quite frankly, have much bigger and much more important issues like getting their populations out of poverty, making sure that they actually achieve some of the things that we have now achieved over the last 200 years with the Industrial Revolution. It's not surprising that they want to have enough food, they want to have enough opportunity, that they want to have easy, cheap, and reliable access to energy and electricity. And so we really have to say this is not about making everyone poorer, worse off, because that's never going to work. This has to be about innovation. It's always been about innovation. That's how we've solved big problems in the world in the past, and this is how we're going to solve climate change. We need to spend a lot more resources on research and development, because that's cheap and that's effective, and it'll probably have a lot of other benefits. But we're talking, tens of billions of dollars in cost rather than what we're talking about with climate policy, which is tens of trillions of dollars, which nobody can afford.
Well, the other thing that Kerry does that's, so annoying, but it's just what these politicians do, is they give you one data point. That doesn't include any trade-offs. So 7 million7 million people die from pollution-related illnesses. I don't know if that statistic is true or not, but 80% of the world's energy comes from fossil fuels, and we know that if we're not using those natural resources to power an economy and to provide heat and air conditioning and all of the other amenities of the modern world, even in the developing world, then you're going to have a body count that is exponentially higher than that. And so, we never get the we it's the same thing we did during COVID. We pretend we can live in a world without trade-offs.
Yes. And we actually live in a world with trade-offs. So the statistic is correct that a lot of people die from air pollution from fossil fuels. But remember, many more people die from not having enough access to energy. So the reality here is, if, for instance, we didn't have fossil fuels, about 4 billion people, not million, but billion people are right now reliant on our synthetic fertilizer. So if we didn't have gas to produce that, basically 4 billion people would be dying. So we really need to remember that most of our infrastructure today is set up with fossil fuels. As you mentioned, it's about 80% of all energy that comes from fossil fuels. Now, again, it makes sense to try to aim for a society where we have lower use of fossil fuels, because CO2 does lead to global warming, which in the long run will have a net negative impact. But there are trade-offs. Making people much, much poorer in order to achieve that is actually going to leave everyone much worse off. A new estimate of the total cost and benefit of going net zero by 2050 estimates that the net benefit over the 21st century will be about $4.5 trillion in benefits. So that's real, and that's something we should take into account. But the net cost, as I mentioned before, is $27 trillion. So we're going to be spending $7 for every $1 benefit. That's a really bad deal. And of course, one that you won't get most populations to accept when their politicians try to latch on to net zero.
Well, who benefits? Who benefits from all this spending? Who benefits from?
There's a lot of
Who are the beneficiaries?
Well, we're essentially creating a whole new subsidized industry. So obviously, people who produce solar and wind, people who produce electric cars. Again, remember, electric cars are fun and great for some things, but requiring everyone to buy them when the vast majority of people actually don't want them necessitate that you spend a lot of money on subsidies. And then you also eventually talk about forcing people to just move over to an electric car by telling you can't have the gas or diesel operated car that you want. So we're essentially creating a whole new economy of subsidies. That was what you heard John Kerry talk about, all these jobs that are going to be provided. Well, right. If these jobs are provided with subsidies that you then have to tax other people to pay for, ultimately that end up making you poorer. You are not richer by subsidizing people. Now, there is a real issue here, but again, subsidizing your way out of it is just not affordable, even for rich countries. We've seen that in Germany very clearly, and obviously not a solution at all for China, India, and Africa.
Well, the other thing, too, is, I mean, talking about what the ROI will be or the potential negative impacts will be in 2050 or 2100. I mean, you know, the modeling and the studies, many of them have not exactly held up to scrutiny over the previous generations in terms of predicting 20 or 30 or 40 years ago where we'd be today. So, you know, it seems to me even those models that are telling us where we'll be in 30 years if we do X or we do Y or 75 mm-hmm. years, I mean, I don't know how much stock we should put in those either.
No, I mean, I take your sort of skepticism, and there has been a lot of really bad predictions about what would happen. You know, we're going to run out of forests, and we're going to run out of oil and aluminum and whatever you want. There's been a lot of these bad forecasts. The estimates that I'm talking about are not actually those kinds of predictions that that rely on exaggeration. But fundamentally, if you see the temperature veer off from what it used to be, you're going to have costs because we built our infrastructure to the current climate. And so it's likely that we will have, you know, in a future that's warmer, we'll have lower heating costs, which is great, especially for people living in northern regions. But we'll have higher cooling costs. We'll have a different set of infrastructure that we'll need to build. That'll have cost. It won't be the end of the world by any means, but it will be, you know, reasonably costly. And that's what they're modeling. But I think we need to wake up to the fact that the policies we're trying to follow in order to deal with this are going to be much, much more expensive. So essentially, we're saying let's pay a lot more for the cure than the original ailment would have cost us. And that's a bad deal.
He is Bjorn Lomborg, president of the Copenhagen Consensus Think Tank, author of Best Things First as well. Bjorn, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you, sir. Good to talk to you guys.
And Bjorn Lomborg joined us on the Turnkey.pro answer line.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Aunt Amy this morning. John Cass, johncassnews.com.
Hey, Dan. Good morning.
Morning. Piece by Jonathan Haidt, extended piece over at The Atlantic. Jonathan Haidt's a psychology professor at NYU, and he's, one of the founders of Heterodox Academy, and he's sort of a center left that's moved a little bit closer center right in these times. Writing about this surge that happened well before COVID. It seems to be like everything is related to the COVID repercussions, and there's something mm-hmm. to that. But when it comes to mental health for adolescents, there was a dramatic spike in the problem well before COVID. He writes, something suddenly and horribly wrong went suddenly and horribly wrong for adolescents in the early 2010s. Rates of depression and anxiety in the United States rose by more than 50% in many studies between 2010 and 2019. The suicide rate rose 48% for adolescents between 10 and 19. For girls aged 10 to 14, it rose 131%. The spike in loneliness and friendliness, which happened for me like 1988. But we're talking about this time period here.
Right.
And he asks simple question, thinking about this. What happened in the early 2010s that altered adolescent development and worsened mental health? Well, your boys were teenagers about this time period, right, John?
I think it's the phone. I didn't read Mr. Heitz's piece. Is that what he's talking about, though?
That is what he's talking about. In point of fact,
we did not allow the boys to have phones, smartphones, while they were young teenagers. Later, when they were driving, they had a phone, but when they're young teenagers, no. And I would look at it, and the phenomenon was upsetting to me because Betty and I would look at people who would brag about their little 4-year-old and 2-year-old, like my daughter's on the phone now. She knows how to go, negotiate and search out Google and so forth. And I would think, what a horrible, horrible thing to do to your child. But they did it, and that's what we have now.
Well, in point of fact, the name of the piece is End the Phone-Based Childhood Now. And he writes about the phone, which is his theory as well.
Right.
Although the underlying psychology is complex, those were the years, the early 2010s.
Right.
When adolescents in rich countries traded in their flip phones for smartphones and moved much more of their social lives online, particularly onto social media platforms designed for virility and addiction. Once young people began carrying the entire internet in their pockets available to the night and day, it altered their daily experiences and developmental pathways across the board. Friendship, dating, sexuality, exercise, sleep, academics, politics, family dynamics, identity, all were affected. And that just got more relentless, I suppose, this impact, when it was iPads in the elementary schools, too, while you're at it. I mean, if you remember, before COVID, we were talking about this problem of kids and screen time. And, of course, that all went by the boards because screen time wasn't a problem anymore. It couldn't be because we were locking down the schools and putting all the kids behind screens. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. I'll tell you something interesting about this, too, because I just had this conversation with Coleman Hughes. He's a bright young guy. Yeah, he's got a new book out, The End of Racism. And I did an interview of him for my podcast, which will post tomorrow. And he points to the decline in race relations that happened about this same time to social media in great significance. So you think, well, I mean, and if you look at the Gallup polling, it's really clear. It's really clear, like race relations all the way to Obama, like, how whites and blacks, what's your view of like how whites and blacks get along, basically? And it was, it was on the increase for 20 years up until the early 2010s.
That people were getting along.
Getting along was better. Yeah. Right. Both sides said race relations were better. A majority of both sides said race relations are better. Mm-hmm. And, race was not the thing that was most top of mind, particularly for Black Americans. So that was good. But then you saw a precipitous decline. And what Hugh says, well, there's a couple things. I mean, the Obama years didn't help in terms of his race-based politics. But it was social media, because every police incident, for example, where it's a white cop and a black person or suspect, and there's violence or there's something that seems like that there's excessive force. I mean, it's just like obsessed, right? You get so much attention. And then you over extrapolate from this one incident to say there's something fundamentally wrong with the police in this country. And it's played over and over again on cable news, and it's shared all over social media repeatedly. And the more demagoguery, the more attention you get to sort of stoke people's irrational fears.
None of this was lost on the left. They were the ones stoking it.
Yeah. Well, right. Or yeah, and maybe they couldn't have predicted, but they certainly could observe it when it was happening and say, "There's there's some value to this."
Right.
Susan in Cedar Lake, Indiana.
Yeah, hi Dan. I saw this in my field. I'm a nurse, and we saw so much of an increase in adolescent inpatient psychiatric admissions during that time. And we, as nurses, we said, it's got to be social media. These teenagers were threatening to commit suicide because their parents took their phone away. It was like, you're grounded from your phone. They wanted to kill themselves. And then we actually had like units in the hospital for adolescent psychiatry have boomed and was like full 24 patients at a time. Social media is the devil for kids. We saw it in the hospital, anxiety, depression, suicide attempts, all this trans stuff. And we saw it, in the hospital with psychiatric visits.
Good
Thanks
call,
for the call,
because
Susan.
In the late 1980s, American medicine had pulled out surgical wards. They destroyed them and they cleaned them out and turned them into psych wards. When Johnny would get caught smoking a joint or having a joint in his sock, and you didn't have to put him in jail, so you put him into a treatment program, 28 days. That's where the 28 days comes from. And they just put him in there, and they made fortunes. And then it was ready when social media came in, as the caller points out, and people were losing their bearings. It was ready again to take more money from people, more suicides, more threats of suicide, and so forth. Yeah.
Something else that Height points out, though, it's not the only change that's occurred in the last couple of generations, and there's a backstory here that's relevant.
What?
He writes that beginning as long ago as the 1980s, we started systemically depriving children and adolescents of freedom, unsupervised play, responsibility, and opportunities for risk-taking, all of which promote competence, maturity, and mental health. But the change accelerated in the early 2010s when an already independence-deprived generation was lured into a new virtual universe that seems safe to parents but in fact is more dangerous in many respects than the physical world. But I just want to point this other piece. So what preceded social media is this, and Leonard Sachs, also a psychologist, makes this point as well. Unsupervised play, responsibilities, opportunities for risk-taking. So it makes this generation, or the Gen Z in particular, the most risk-averse.
You can see it now. How
least responsible. The least independent. And it was a sort of a cascading effect. That there was a cascading 100%. Effect going on even before the smartphones.
They had it, and for example, many coaches, like the sport that you hate but I love, soccer. Many soccer coaches and point this out, and I talk to baseball guys too. They pointed out that they're You know, mommy drives you to the practice. There's no more going out to the neighborhood, taking your ball out there and looking up a game, looking up guys. Let's play a game, because everything has to be structured. Everything.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Mary Kay, Western Springs.
Hey, you know, I was thinking about just the isolation alone, not just COVID, but the fact that you can carry your devices around and you have something to do. You have something in your hand, so you're not, you know, interacting with people. It was like people who used to, you know, have a book with them all the time, because, you know, if you had your eyes in a book, you weren't alone, you know, like you had, I don't know. I mean,
you had
I think
an excuse,
sense, you know?
Right? Yeah.
Yes, definitely. And, I mean, people that I know in this neighborhood that I live in, John, they would send their kids to wilderness camp after their kids were, you know, parents started to find out and realize their kids were in the basement playing 1,500 hours of those crazy video games. I mean, so I have a friend who said my kid's off the grid and going to wilderness camp somewhere in upstate New York to get away from this addiction. And the other thing I wanted to say is, you know, the 12-step programs, you know, Al-Anon and AA and Families Anonymous and all those programs, there should be for addiction to the phone, too. You know,
we used to hit Mary Kay. I'm, you know, I raised the kids in Western Springs, where you're from or where had been from. And I'm just going to say there was a radical, and this is for you, too, Dan, and everybody listening. There was a radical program when my kids were little and when I was a little boy. It's called the Boy Scouts of America. Anyone hear about it?
Uh-huh.
You go out, camp.
I love it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You don't have a phone?
I was a Girl Scout leader for 8 years.
Right.
Yeah.
Thanks for the call, Mary Kay. The numbers. The most recent Gallup data show American teens spend about 5 hours a day just on social media platforms.
Jesus Christ.
Add in all the other phone and screen-based activities, the number rises somewhere between 7 and 9 hours a day. The numbers are even higher in single-parent and low-income families, and that does not include time spent in front of screens for school or homework.
But that alters their understanding of reality. They become more susceptible to the fantasy genre and fantasy. They believe in fantasy as real. So
well,
that's what happens.
Maybe. That's a part of it. But certainly there's, I mean, as we were just talking about with Bjorn Lundberg, there's trade-offs.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're on social media for 5 or 7 or 9 hours a day, then you can't be doing these other things.
Well, you can't be reading The Road to Serfdom by Hayek. You can't be
I suppose
that.
You could be reading it online, but yeah, but probably not.
Same,
mm-hmm. Bill and Beverly, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, I'm a doctor, internist, and pediatrician, and I routinely ask my parents now the question, how many hours a day is your child on the phone? And it's very important to limit it. We've seen a spike in depression and anxiety. And I encourage people to get out in the real world, get your hands dirty, plant some seeds, go in the woods, walk around, go to the garden, get real, give life. We got to have tangible, understandable of God's creation. That's what will restore us. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call, Bill.
That's a great call, Doctor. Yeah.
Dan and John Cass in for Amy J. Chicago's Morning Answer.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.